Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And this type of system, in order to get started, does take a little more work up front. But the good part about that is, over time, there's lower maintenance with higher yields.
That's Jonas Carpenter of Bread and Roses Gardens. He's talking about their polycultural system of growing food and raising animals, which mimics aspects of the forest. Today, lots and lots of hard work is on the docket. We'll get a tutorial in sheet mulching. Before that, Harvest Public Media says farmers in Kansas are loving all this early spring snow. And in the kitchen, Chef Daniel Orr prepares some maple-glazed turnips and polenta with Brussels sprouts. Two dishes using some cold, hearty veggies. Stay with us. Welcome to Luann Johnson. She has the latest in food news headlines for us.
Hey, Annie. Four stories today. Quietly passed last Thursday was a provision allowing the USDA to permit the planting of genetically modified crops, even if a judge had ruled against it. The provision, dubbed the Monsanto Protection Act, was part of legislation designed to prevent the shutdown of the federal government that would have begun on March 27th. Although the ruling angered environmental and organic groups, it wasn't entirely new. In the past, the USDA has received the green light to continue planting GMOs while waiting for environmental impact reports to arrive, such as in the example of a 2010 sugar beet case. While healthy school lunches are by no means a magic bullet in combating childhood obesity, a recent study has found that increased offerings of fruits and vegetables at schools do make a measurable difference in kids' consumption of these foods. Researchers found that students who lived in states requiring a minimum number of fruit and vegetable servings in school lunches consumed significantly more fruit and vegetables than students in other states. California and Mississippi are currently the only states with laws on the books mandating fruit and vegetable minimums in school lunches. A coalition of environmentalists and beekeepers are suing the Environmental Protection Agency for failing to protect bee populations from the impacts of harmful pesticides. The lawsuit focuses on neonicotinoids, or neonics, which are applied to the seeds of many popular crops before they're planted. When the coated seed sprouts, the pesticide spreads throughout the growing plant, making it toxic to any bug that tries to eat it. Neonics are the world's most popular pesticides. In the U.S., they are most frequently used in corn farming. And, according to a statement made by the Hellenic Food Safety Authority, samples of Greek chicken nuggets have tested positive for horse meat. Europe's horse meat woes began in January when equine DNA was detected in Irish beef products. Since then, horse meat has been found in products ranging from Swedish meatballs to British frozen lasagna. Fortunately, Europeans' unwitting horse consumption hasn't resulted in any acute health problems in humans. While concerns that the toxic anti-inflammatory drug, phenylbutazone, could enter the food chain through horse meat, tests for dangerous concentrations of the substance have so far come up negative. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org, and check out Twitter and Facebook for food news updates all day long. Find us by searching for Earth Eats.
Luann Johnson, thanks for the news.
You got it.
Two big rapid-fire snowstorms recently belted Kansas, dropping more than 2 feet of snow. They caused thousands of accidents, all kinds of hardships, and yet produced some very broad smiles. Because as Frank Morris of Harvest Public Media reports, in a place as dry as Kansas has been lately, a blizzard can be a blessing.
So imagine your job is taking care of 450 cows, and almost half of them have either just given birth to calves or are just about to, out in a pasture where 2 feet of snow has fallen in the past week and a half. One thing you need is an old axe, like the one Kirk Sowers carries down to the frozen pond.
One side's a good side and one side's the ice side.
Sowers is covered in layers of heavy canvas work clothes with a big gray mustache and cowboy hat to match.
Chopping some ice, keeping the ponds open for them to drink. This pond's still in pretty decent shape. I've got 16 dry ponds on the ranch.
And that's most of them. The drought here near Tonganoxie, Kansas, started last spring and hasn't let up.
Our pastures here, a lot of it looks dead when the snow's gone.
Drought had baked the soil here to bone dry dust, so Sowers has been forced to buy scarce and very expensive hay.
Whoop! Whoop! Boss gets their attention. That sound will carry a little farther than, hey, come here, cow.
Now, with snow covering what grass there is, and the cows rapidly turning out other little mouths to feed, he's using much more.
I like to keep a lot of extra hay out, give them a dry place to lay during the night, and especially if they want to lay down and have a baby sometime. They've got a nice dry place to do it. It is expensive, yeah.
But for all this, Sowers is pretty sweet on the snow.
It makes for a little harder work. But in the scope of the drought, man, we're just almost giddy about having the snow.
Because the snow melt will start to quench these pastures. And if you think Sowers is happy, you should call a Kansas wheat farmer, one out west, where the drought is now entering its third year.
I was beginning to wonder if it could rain.
Scott Van Allen hails from Sumner County, Kansas, which proudly boasts it's the wheat capital of the world.
This is the first time I really haven't minded going out and shoveling my sidewalks off. I had a smile the whole time I was doing it.
Because the snow's brought the first real moisture to Van Allen's wheat crop since he planted it last fall. Jim Schroyer, a wheat expert at Kansas State University, says he's asked all the time if the storms broke the drought.
No, but it sure as heck helps. It's better than a good sharp poke in the eye.
Schroyer says it's been so dry for so long that it would take 8 feet of snow to bring the soil back to normal in western Kansas, where normal is pretty dry. So the snow wasn't so much a lifesaver for the wheat crop so much as it was a stay of execution.
This wheat crop is going to be going hand to mouth from this point on.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the tires on Kirk Sauer's huge four-wheel drive pickup are slipping a little.
Yeah, when you get this truck stuck, you're stuck.
Snow is melting, and the ranch is going to get very messy.
I have learned one thing over the last 35 years of doing this, that you don't cuss the mud. I'd much rather have mud than dust.
And for now, mud it is in Kansas after the snow melts. And next month, maybe green. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Spring snowstorms be damned, we're still talking about gardening today. Last week, the snow and cold temperatures didn't really matter because we checked out what was growing inside the hoop house at Bread and Roses Gardens. This week, we're braving the elements with Salem Willard and Jonas Carpenter as they sheet mulch a plot of land in preparation for some goji berry trees.
There's the cat. Hello, Apollo.
There are kitty paw prints on all the cars.
Apollo isn't alone. There are a couple dozen ducks and chickens, and several pigs who are employed to clear some land that was then planted as a nut grove. Perennial crops like these are planted next to annuals, with the goal of mimicking patterns found in the forest. Carpenter calls it a polycultural system.
And this type of system, in order to get started, does take a little more work up front. But the good part about that is, over time, there's lower maintenance with higher yields. Unlike just focusing on annual crops where it's the same and, you know, the same amount of input for same yields every year.
Bread and Roses Gardens is an expansive area of land, but Willard is certain that the techniques they're using can be applied to a front yard.
Usually what you see in people's front yards are grass with a few trees, maybe a nice oak, a big canopy tree there, but there's still a lot of sunlight. We would just promote, you know, incorporating a few different edible trees, you know, instead of an ornamental pear, why not plant one that's going to feed you? And it takes the same amount of work to get it started, to get it planted, to get it established. And after that, you've got food to eat year after year.
That's all fine and good, but we've gotten ahead of ourselves. How do you get rid of the plant that typically has free reign over all American front yards? Grass.
Rip it out. Put in something that you can eat, you know?
It's really that simple?
Well, there are a lot of strategies for getting rid of grass.
Yeah.
I mean, here on the property, we didn't have a lot of sod to deal with, and we used pigs to till up. But typically, we're trying to avoid the use of tillage, which is a typical way people do get rid of grass, or think they get rid of grass. They till it in and it comes back up, and it's weedy. And so often our strategy to get rid of grass would be to sheet mulch, or some people call it lasagna gardening, where you use biomass or carbon materials like cardboard, newspaper, leaf materials. Like in the tropics, they would use banana leaves. And then the use of lots of wood chips, grass clippings, leaves, things like that, essentially to kind of snuff the grass out.
Then you establish a living ground cover. It could attract beneficial pollinators or deter pests. Anything that serves to snuff out the grass, really. Today, the guys are doing some sheet mulching, not to get rid of grass, but just to prepare the soil to be planted. They're transforming one of the slopes on the property into raised garden beds.
So up here, we're starting a new terrace. We're kind of working up the hillside slowly and trying to accommodate plants that want a little bit of a higher and drier location. In this case, we're planting goji berries, which is also known as wolfberry. Very desirable product because the berries have a lot of essential amino acids, high in beta carotene. They're known as a superfood, and they cost a lot at market. No one can grow them locally, so we're doing it though. I mean, we found that they pretty much grow just like a blackberry would, and they really want a high, dry location. They don't mind sandy soils, clay soils. They're very adaptable. So we're going to put a few in the ground.
So the first thing that you guys had to do in order to get this land ready for what we're going to do today, first of all, you have to take down a bunch of trees.
Well, in this case, yes. There are a lot of poplar trees that were in the way that were threatening to crush the greenhouse and other things. So the amount of arable land here is limited. So I wanted to take advantage of the south slope here. It stores a lot of heat here in the hillside. It doesn't get as cold as down in the valley. You know, even though we're only about 15 feet higher than the valley floor, it stays a good 10 degrees warmer up here most of the day.
This style of terracing can be done without this much slope as well. Often, what we'll do is dig a swale, which is basically a trench on contour in front of the bed. And what that does is it acts to catch water and nutrients that's coming downhill and slowly seep into the soil, which will help retain a lot more moisture.
Well, you're standing on, a pizza box and some junk mail. What on earth does this have to do with a garden?
Well, this is the sheet mulch. This is what we'll be using to block out weeds, block out grass from coming back in the short term. In the long term, the living ground covers, the living mulch, basically, will be in place, and that will prevent new weeds from going up.
So literally, you just put the paper and the cardboard down and it...
Yeah, so right now, Jonas is putting a goji in the ground here. And what we're going to do is add a layer of sheet mulch around the plant to provide a little buffer zone to keep other weeds from going back and in that space.
And, you know, most any paper will biodegrade. I mean, the shiny stuff, the like regular newspaper, cardboard is the best because it's thick. The key is you do want to make sure you cover it completely with whatever mulch you're using, because any exposed cardboard takes longer to break down. It dries out. It doesn't get the moisture. So typically,
and it
looks ugly. So hide it. It serves a great function, but here we're putting kind of just a planting around the goji here. But we're also going to plant in ground covers, so that's our aim, is let them quickly establish and take over and outcompete the grasses.
Some castings there.
They're using the dirt dug up when creating the swale to form raised beds. They then load the soil with all sorts of nutrients, including granite dust from Willard's home state of Georgia. This system really does require a lot of work up front, but it'll maintain itself with minimal additional work from the farmers. One final step. These are just wood chips?
Yeah, and that's a common question people ask when they come out here. It's like, where are all these chips coming from? Where are you getting all your mulch? And we're fortunate to live a mile away from a sawmill. And so it's a byproduct of the sawmill, and we've bought a lot of lumber from him for building.
So, and you're applying this heavily for one little plant.
Yeah, we're gonna cover the entire bed heavily. You know, the first time we go through, we're gonna put down somewhere around 4 inches of mulch as an average. It's one, because we have a lot, but two, if we do it now, it acts as a double action to snuff out the weeds. And the reason we use wood mulch is because it's highly beneficial for fungal activity in the soil. So our fungus friends, who are there and just waiting to help us out, are fed and give them a home. They kind of act as the internet of the soil. They spread information, being nutrient and disease. You know, there's something's going around in the forest. That's how the forest works.
That's making me think of morels. You guys going to get some morels around here, you think?
Yeah, definitely.
More than likely. And doing this kind of work, I've seen many gardens that use this kind of type of mulching in town and suburban areas that find morels. The only thing I can see with mulch that sometimes has a negative effect, if you put down a lot of mulch and there's not enough nitrogen in the soil. This is one fear people have about using wood mulch. But nitrogen is something that you can easily come about. It leaves our body every day in the form of urine, which is one way. Or there's also organic nitrogen sources out there.
Are you guys peeing on your plants?
We pee all over the garden, and we encourage everyone to, not on the annuals. You don't want to pee on your leafy greens that you're going to take to the dinner table that night, but woody plants and especially soil, especially piles of wood chips. You have a pile of wood chips in the winter, pee on them, or in the anytime. So yeah,
guys, this has been such a pleasure. Thanks for letting me come out.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
You have the best office. See photos of Salem Willard and Jonas Carpenter laying down sheet mulch on our website, eartheats.org. Next week, the guys show off their 4 solar panels that give them all the electricity they need. Good thing, too, because they can't connect to the grid. Be sure to come back for that. Coming up, it's amazing how tasty Brussels sprouts can be after a quick blanch.
But I really like that they're crunchy. They're almost like a crudité vegetable. You could eat them cold like this and just dip them into a blue cheese dip.
But Chef Daniel Orr is going to reheat them and pair them with some polenta and a couple slices of stinky cheese. This recipe is a real goodie. Come back to hear more.
Chocolate-covered Brussels sprouts, I want chocolate-covered cheese. Pass the chocolate tuna casserole, if you please. Chocolate in my alphabet soup, I don't mind those P's and Q's. Hey, I'll take another chocolate-covered Brussels sprout, how about you?
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. A while back, we asked for requests of ingredients to cook with in upcoming recipes. Plenty of our Twitter followers asked for Brussels sprouts recipes, which we have coming up. The first one is a treat for me personally, and it uses some delicious local maple syrup to boot. I think I was the one who requested recipes for turnips because I have so many and I can't figure out how to make them tasty.
Well, turnips, you know, they're kind of a forgotten vegetable, an old-timey vegetable, but they are delicious. And their whole dishes in France called navarins, which are all about the navet, which the French turnip in French is navet. And so a navarin is a stew made with turnips. It usually has lamb in it, so that's a wonderful dish. We're going to do something more kind of Hoosier and down home, using Tim Burton's maple syrup. So what you need to do is pick out a nice turnip. They should be shiny. See how that it's kind of shiny, and if you feel the texture of it, very, very smooth. If it's wrinkly and soft, then it's not going to be good. It's going to become kind of bitter from being in storage too long. If you can get them with the greens, the turnip greens are edible as well. Cook them just like anything else. If you love pork, throw some bacon in there, stew them down. Delicious. If you don't, you could use some toasted walnuts with them, a little bit of balsamic vinegar, great way to cook the turnip greens. Again, a little bit of sweetness always helps with the greens too, because they can be a little bit bitter. So just a little bit of honey, agave, even some brown sugar would be fine, just a pinch. You don't want to be sickly sweet, just to kind of cover up that touch of bitterness. So basically with the turnip bulb, what we're going to do is dice it up. I would say about half inch pieces, and then steam it off. And you'll come up with a turnip much like this. Now, this is a little hot, but if you want to taste it, it should still be a little bit crunchy.
You just throw this in your mouth. It's so hot. Oh, my God. Okay. Crunchy. Well.
Crunchy. All right. So we have these ready. They're cooked. They're hot. They're kind of steaming. Now we're going to put together the sauce for them. So just a touch of oil, minced onions, teaspoon, garlic. Just going to let those become a little tender. We don't want them to be super soft. And I'm going to throw a couple dried chili peppers. We're going to leave them whole, and that way we can take them out. So if you're wanting to get a chili flavor, but you don't want to have it too hot, so that's always a good trick. I just added about 2 tablespoons of maple syrup. And now I'm going to add some chopped kumquats. I've got 4 kumquats. They look like little tiny oranges, and you can eat the whole thing. You can eat the skin and all. You can squeeze out the seeds, but I even eat the seeds. And they've got a really nice perfumey orange flavor. Okay, we're going to dump our turnips in, and that's about 1 large turnip. This would be enough for a side vegetable for probably 4 people. And finally, just to make it a little bit better, we got my butter. And the butter is going to enrobe the turnips, give them a nice shine.
Maybe that's the thing. I'm not cooking my turnips with a tablespoon of butter.
Well, the butter, I mean, when you're eating all these great local vegetables, a little butter is going to make them even more special and something to look forward to. Okay, I got the sweetness, touch of spice. I get that little bit of orange flavor. I'm going to throw in some greens just to make them look pretty. This is some chopped parsley and scallions. Let me put these out on the plate. You can give them a try.
Serve this dish with a pork chop, some grilled chicken, or a fatty piece of salmon. Nice side dish and very colorful. See photos and the complete recipe at eartheats.org. Brussels sprouts lovers are going to love you.
Yes, ma'am. We're going to turn everybody into a Brussels sprout lover today. What we've done today is we've blanched them, and blanching means that we've taken some boiling salted water and we've plunged the raw vegetables into the boiling water, cooked them until they're al dente, and al dente means to the tooth in Italian, and then we've plunged them into cold water, which is called shocking, and you really want to use ice water. That brings the temperature down, keeps the integrity of the vegetable, and keeps them nice and green colored.
There's some chew there.
Yeah. We're going to cook them again, so we don't want to have them overcooked. But I really like that they're crunchy. They're almost like a crudité vegetable. You could eat them cold like this and just dip them into a blue cheese dip. I mean, that'd be a delicious way to enjoy Brussels sprouts. We're going to heat up some oil in a sauté pan. And I've got round discs of polenta. And polenta, basically in southern Indiana, it's what we call cornmeal mush. All right, so we want to get a nice brown crust on both sides so it's crunchy on the exterior and then it's nice and soft on the inside. And what we're going to do is use those on the bottom of the plate with some taleggio on top. And taleggio is a wonderful Italian cheese. It's kind of like a super stinky brie. So if you like brie and you like funky cheeses, you're going to love taleggio. And I don't get it all the time back here in Indiana, so it's fun when I find it. And I wanted to share it with everybody at Earth Eats. Okay, now it's starting to crunch up on that first side. This is one of those things you don't want to rush. The more you move it around, the harder it is to get that nice crust build on the outside. It's kind of like mushrooms. You put them in there, you let them sit there by themselves. Don't try to move them around too much, and your final product will be a lot better.
Hard to not fiddle with your food when you're cooking it.
Right? You always want to check it, look on the bottom. But it's very, very important that you get a nice crust on these. Sprinkle them with just a little grated Parmesan. You can hear that cheese starting to sizzle and stick to the bottom of the tray. And this is the part of the process you really don't want to rush. They should all be able just to kind of slide around. Okay, you know they're ready when you can kind of shake them around in the pan and they don't stick. Okay, I'm going to take this, put this on a side plate. And then with the same pan, I'm going to cook our Brussels sprouts. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to plunge them into the hot water, and just to kind of warm them through a little bit. In the meantime, I'm going to put some chopped garlic into the saute pan. My Brussels sprouts are pretty much hot, and there's a little bit of water still on them. Throw those in the pan. Okay, and now I'm going to make up a plate. Okay, so I got a couple of the polenta rounds on the plate. We're going to surround it with some steaming, garlicky Brussels sprouts. Slice of the taleggio. And just a little bit of chopped herbs. Touch of olive oil to give it a shine. And those are some of the best Brussels sprouts you'll ever have. Go ahead and let me know if I'm right.
All right, let's go check this out. It's nice. Whew, this really was a good one. You can experiment with making your own polenta or pick some up from the store. Either way, definitely do not forget that taleggio. That's really the key to this recipe for sure. Get more inspiration for your kitchen adventures on our website, eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Ahabon Binder, Jonas Carpenter, Sarah Gordon, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Salem Willard, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for listening, and thanks for tuning in this week. See you soon. I'm Annie Corrigan.